Okay. I'm Bob Connolly, and we're going to have 3 weeks of this concentration on rigidity and symmetry. And I'll give a little talk that will touch on various aspects of rigidity, a little bit of symmetry, and this week it's mostly rigidity. Next week the first half is again maybe rigidity and symmetry, symmetric objects or such, and then we'll go into polyhedral symmetry at the end of next week and the week after. So stay tuned. I don't know what else to say. If you have any questions while I'm talking, please feel free to interrupt me. It makes things better and keeps me honest. Okay, so I'm interested in rigidity. I've been interested in rigidity for some time. And let me give just sort of a rough outline of what kinds of rigidity there are. There's what now has been called local rigidity, rigidity of objects that is just nearby. If you can move the object maintaining the distance constraints, let's say, then you say it's not locally rigid. So it's a very general thing. Infinitesimal rigidity is the linearization of rigidity. Global rigidity is a global sense, whether there's another configuration in Euclidean space. Universal rigidity is where the object sits in some Euclidean space and is rigid in all higher dimensions. There's been interest in all of those subjects recently. And then you can apply the word generic to all of them. Generic meaning is nothing special. It's very general. So, so there are all kinds of things like that. And then there are objects that are rigid. Bar and joint, which just seems to be a standard, old standard. Tensegrity frameworks, which I'll explain, and there's some models here. In fact, I think maybe the best way to understand tensegrity frameworks or many of these things is to see models, to see examples. And then there are bar and body, body and hinge, panel and hinge, on and on. Now, I'm not going to go into definitions of all of them. There are 7 categories before and 5 here. That makes 35 definitions. Do you really want me to do 35 definitions?
No.
Okay. Henry, I'll talk to you later. Anyway, so that's the general outline. Now, before we start, I think the best way to understand tensegrity is to see models. Now, a lot of the models that I have here, before I talk about the particular application I have in mind, are these. Now, here's, well, you can actually play with these things. I meant to shine them up, but you can see the springs are supposed to be cables. One of the first tensegrities was this thing with 3 sticks, or I call them struts, suspended by 6, 9 cables like this. Now, the cables are elastics, and you might say that's not truly a tensegrity. It had to be like strings. But it works with cables like this, too. This was, discovered, invented by an artist, Kenneth Snelson. Actually, other people did things like it earlier, but you can see that it has its whole, it holds its shape. This is a variation on it, where you replace the triangle with a Y, and so on. And this is a recent one that we fussed with. I'm writing a book on tensegrities and rigidity with an engineer, Simon Guest, and we asked Branko Grünbaum for one of his examples like this, and this is one of Branko's examples. It's something that I hadn't played with until recently. The little balls are points. This is something like a tensegrity tower that Snelson built. Although it's not like this. He was chicken. He put extra cables in here to make it more stable. This is a little a little wobbly, but it's rigid, really. So, and there are various other variations like this. These are things by Rick Flowerday and so on, lots of variations. One of my favorites is this. This is a tensegrity, a model built by Rinus Roelofs. I met him at Henry's conference, and I put a classical tensegrity inside with the same symmetries. So these are just slats like this. I think there are 30 slats like this. They're all fit together. That's all. No glue. No thing. Of course, when you make it, you need to support it. Now, making it is the tough thing. So you can see this. I don't know if you want to pass it around. But they're all about 30 slats like this, and you put them all together. So it's a very clever design. So just a plug for a computer program that I wrote with Alan Back and Bob Terrell. I don't know how Simon Guest got in there. But anyway, this is something. If you go to my website, you can see this, and you can build, you can see models of various types of tensegrities. Here's one. And you have to make choices. You have to make choices of the symmetry, the abstract symmetry group, the elements in the group that represent cables, and the elements in the group that represent struts, and then the ratio between stresses of various members in the tensegrity. And then I'll pop this, and you can play around with it, and it'll give you exact distances, relative sizes of things. Anyway, that's a plug for tensegrity. This is sort of a more involved sort of tensegrity, but the kind I want to talk about is a little bit simpler. Something I call spider webs, but I'll talk about that in a minute. So what I'd like to do is talk about, well, these are some applications, structural mechanics, mechanical structures. Walter will talk about things that move. I discovered a thing that moved a long time ago. And what I'd like to do is talk about packings and stability of packings. I think just to concentrate on that one example. And it brings up a lot of the types of rigidity, a lot of the ideas that are involved, but in a very simplified form. So I thought there'd be a way of introducing things. So this is the application. You have it's an old subject where you want to find the most dense packing of something and something. And there are sort of natural questions that you want to ask when you have such a question. You want to know what the packing elements are. Usually those are disks, round disks, let's say in the plane. But it could be in any dimension. It could be even different shaped disks, usually convex, but not always. You want some sort of finiteness to be assumed. Now, this is kind of tricky. So, like, you could pack disks in a square, you could pack circular caps on a sphere. There are lots of possibilities. I'm interested in the local properties of packings that tend to jam when you expand their common radius, let's say, and what I call locally most dense packings. And the next is the most speculative. It's the question, is there an algorithm for it of some sort? How do you find the most dense packings? So these are all kinds of questions you have to, or one should think about before you get into the nitty-gritty. Okay. Now here's, let's have something more picturesque. Here is an example. So for me, I think a good example, a convenient example, where lots of things work for you, is what I call a flat torus. Now, what's a flat torus? You take Euclidean space and divide out by a lattice. In other words, two points on the plane are equivalent if there's a way of translating from one point to the other by the lattice. Now, here's the way I like to think of it. I don't know. I was brought up as a topologist, and I've rejected topology since then. But nevertheless, it does have a point, and it's a good way of thinking of things. So this is the way I think of the situation for a lattice. Up here is R2, and here's the lattice, a bunch of points. And you take the quotient of the plane by this lattice, and you get a torus. So here are all the points in the lattice, and that goes to one point downstairs. And I think of it as a covering space. And and this covers this. And I often don't make the distinction between being down here or up here, although one should if one wants to be careful. So this is the square lattice. You can see it. The points represent the lattice. And, well, I can take a sublattice. So I can take these points. And if you know, this is called a fundamental domain. And you can think of this as the torus, where this side is identified with this, and this side is identified with this. But it's not, you don't do it physically in space, because that distorts the metric. You just identify them. It's a problem. Okay, and then you try to pack those round disks inside this torus, which is given by these lattice. Now, there's another lattice involved here, which gives you the packing. So this is a packing of, let's see, you can tell by the colors. This is a packing of 1, 2, 3, 4, is it 5? 5 disks in what I call a square torus. With me here? Okay. All right, so that's an example of that thing. Okay, so let's look at this. So the question is, which lattice? There is some degree of freedom here. Now, one thing you can do is vary the lattice, vary the shape, what I call the shape of the torus, as well as the lattice, or not. You can fix the lattice. And for granular materials, this is another application of these ideas, it's often useful to vary the shape of the torus. That's like doing a shear or whatever to the actual packing. But sometimes you might want to keep the lattice fixed. So you can ask for a fixed, it's simpler this way, for a fixed lattice, a fixed shape of a torus, and a fixed integer, what's the most dense packing of n congruent circular disks in the torus? You can ask that.
Is there an implication one way or the other between the good packing in the plane and the infinite and the packing in the torus?
Well,
the packings of one, they're not packings of the other?
Well, if you have a packing in a torus, you can do the universal cover, as we know from this, and get a packing in the plane. You can certainly do that. And it's known what the most dense packing of congruent circles are in the plane. This goes back to Tua.
Is there anything else in the torus?
Hang on. So it depends on the shape of the torus, like I said, and n, the number of lattice elements. Okay. Good. All right. So here's some example. Will is in the audience here. You can ask him about it. He was interested in the square torus. I worked with some scientists, Sal Torcato, Stillinger, and Alex Dunniff, and they were obsessed with square tori. They wanted to do granular materials, and everything was, well, okay, I'll identify the left of the right, the top of the bottom. And they said, don't do that. I said, don't do that. Allow the shape to change. And they said, well, okay. Then you look at their pictures, and it was almost square. So they changed the shape of the torus, but only a little bit. But anyway, so let's go with that. Let's keep the shape torus. Now, here's the best packing of one disk. Okay. Yeah, that's cool. Here's the best packing of two disks. See, the white is like this. Now, that thing looks yellow, but I couldn't get the thing to cover. When it covers the blue, it turns yellow. But anyway, that's the shape of two. It's kind of obvious. Three is a little, where is it? Oh, three here is, actually, you should go to 4. Here's the best with 4. Right, Will?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Here's the best with 4. And then the best to get 3 is to remove one of the 4. Huh. How often does that happen? Well, actually, it happens in other situations like that, too. So he did this. He worked this out. Anyway, so that's the kind of question I want to do. But I don't like the square torus. I like the triangular torus. Why? Because we know that this is the best packing. And here is here's a little itty-bitty fundamental region. This is the best packing of one disk in a triangular torus. And we know from the best packing in the plane that you can't do any better. This is the most dense packing. Density is, it's very simple. It's the total area of the disks divided by the area of the torus, which is the determinant of a lattice. Anyway, so this is 1. This is 2. There's a red one and a white one. It seems like you take the best packing for 3 and remove 1. Then, where are we? So this one is 1, 2, 3, 4. Is it 4? And then you remove 1. But I don't think this is right. Right? This is not the best packing. But and we can improve it, and I'll show you why. This is, this is called the Kagome lattice, and I'll show that again later. And although it might look good, you have to hold on. So there's a different answer for each n. But one thing to keep in mind, though, is that if I can stick a triangular lattice inside another triangular lattice, in other words, as a sublattice, one is a sublattice of the other, then that's clearly the best packing. Because we know from Laszlo Feshtov or Tua, whoever you like, that this is the best packing overall, the most dense packing overall. So if you can do that, and what happens is if the number of packings, the number of elements in the triangular torus is of this form, a squared plus ab plus b squared, these are some of the small numbers, I hope I didn't miss any in between there, then those I call lattice triangular numbers. If you have a lattice triangular number, then you can fit a thing in there. This is an example of that sort of thing, and this is another. So here's a sublattice. Here's the actual lattice, and inside that is a superlattice. So you could think of this triangular lattice as a sublattice of the other little triangular lattice, and so that corresponds to a packing of some number, and then these are the numbers that you get. Now, one of the things you can do, suppose you take one of these and remove one of the elements like we did before. You remove one of the packing disks. Then what you get is another packing with one less element. And the question is that really the best? And so here's an example. This is the Kagome lattice, but that has another, this is not, this is actually three packing elements, and it's not the best because there's a triangular packing that you can pack with 3. Is it here somewhere? Where'd it go? Is it here? Yeah, white, red, blue. So this is a triangular lattice with 3. So so that's something to play with. Okay, so let me. So now this is one thing that Will found that really surprised me because I had seen this configuration once before. So the first one that's interesting, so I'll mention a bit later that I think if the number is, well, let me just look at this. So this is the best packing of 5 disks in a triangular lattice. This is sort of a different kind of fundamental region. If you count them, they're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 disks in there. And this is a pentagon, and I'll show you what the pentagon looks like. It looks like that. So these are 120 degrees, so when you go back, you can see what happens is that the Pentagon sent around their corner. Where is this? Well, maybe you don't see it in here, but here in this corner, there's another Pentagon here. I should have put one more in here. So there are three Pentagons around the corner, and they're all symmetric. So this is the best. Will tells us that this is the best pecking of five. Well, why is that interesting? Well, here it is. So this is my conjecture. Suppose you have a number that is such that n plus 1, if you add one more, it's a lattice triangular number. But n itself is not a lattice triangular number. Then I conjecture, I have to tell you about conjectures in a minute. I conjecture that the best packing is a lattice packing. You choose n, and then take one out. You just remove one. Now, this is related to Laszlo Feistoff's conjecture that says that if you take the infinite packing, remove a finite number, remove one, then take another finite number of those left and put them back, put them all back, any way you like, you only put them back with a hole, one hole missing. He calls this compact packing of that sort. And this is an old problem that's been around for years and it's not been solved. An analogous question in the hyperbolic plane has been solved, but and a local version of it has been solved by Imre Barané and Kolya Dobigin. Okay, so, well, like I said, this is my conjecture. I'm a little nervous about a conjecture like this. I have a friend that says that when you make a conjecture and it's true, you should be rewarded. But when you make a conjecture and it's false, you should be punished. So sometimes I go halfway between conjectures and questions. Sometimes you can ask a question, that's fine. So I don't know. If anybody wants to punish me here with a counterexample, that'd be fine. Okay, so this packing of five disks that we saw can't be used as part of a counterexample to my conjecture or Laszlo Feistoff's conjecture because the area of the pentagon is too big. If you use two or more, then the area of that pentagon is bigger than six triangles. And so you're up the creek. You can't do better. You could make a more dense packing with the triangular lattice minus the disk. So anyway, so that's the kind of calculation that one could make. Still no questions? Everybody okay here? Okay. So the question is how to find the best packing. So this is one of the motivations for looking at the triangular lattice because, for one thing, the triangular lattice has a lot of symmetries. And we'll hear a lot about symmetry later on. And that can help in many cases, especially for small numbers. So here's my plan for finding the best packings. You look for graphs that are candidates for best packings. Now, there's a whole bunch of conditions that you can put on the graph, and this has been used in similar situations by Oleg Musin and others. You look for the graph that's the best packing, although there are some difficulties with finding the graph of the packing. The graph of the packing is where you take the centers of the packing elements and you connect two centers if the packing elements touch. And then you get a graph that's on the, you can think of it as a graph on the torus itself. That's the way I think. Okay, then find realizations where they're all the unit distance and choose the packing graph with the largest length. Simple, huh? Yeah, well, okay. So now, this is a conference on rigidity, and rigidity plays a central role here. And here, one of the notions of rigidity is infinitesimal rigidity. Remember, that was one of the kinds of rigidity. So here's a definition of infinitesimal rigidity in this context. Now, you have to realize that these are, I think of these as points on the torus, and this inner product that I'm defining here, what you can do is lift the edge up to the plane and then take this inner product. I think that's a perfectly reasonable way of thinking about it. So what you do is you define little vectors, P primes, one for each point, each node of the graph. And if the this is what's called an infinitesimal flex of the thing, and if one infinitesimal flex on a torus, a fixed torus, an obvious one, is where all these things are constants. That's pretty clear. We call those trivial. Okay. And so if they're only trivial infinitesimal flexes, then you say it's infinitesimally rigid. If there aren't, then there's some non-zero infinitesimal motion, the P primes, and you'll see how this enters in later. Okay. Well, I'm interested in tensegrities, things where there's inequalities along, not just equalities. So here's the definition for what I call a strut framework. Struts are things that can get bigger but not smaller. These, what you see here, are cables. Those are things that can get smaller but not bigger. Here, everything can get bigger. Now you might say, why doesn't it just go off to infinity? Well, if you're in the Euclidean space, yes. But when you're on a torus, you're constrained. You can't at least not locally. You can't locally move off to infinity. So you can say a strut framework is if the only this is an infinitesimal flex of a strut framework. When you have a packing, two packing elements that touch can move apart, but they can't move closer together. So this is very natural. This is the derivative of the distance squared, effectively. Yeah? Okay, I'll repeat. Okay, so the way I think of it, remember I was brought up as a topologist, so I think Pi minus Pj is down here on the torus, and there's an edge, which is a path that goes from Pi to Pj. Then you lift that path to the plane, and that's Pi minus Pj and Pi prime minus Pj prime. So this, it's implicit in this definition that there's a path that's defined, or an edge in the torus that's defined, which is a homotopy class of paths from Pi to Pj. Right. The P primes are in the tangent space of the... Yeah, and that lifts too. The Pi prime, you can think of that as the tangent space, and again, it can be identified with the Euclidean space. Pardon me? Yeah, you can think of the P prime as the same everywhere. You lift the same P prime to all the liftings, if you like. Yeah. I'll show you pictures later where you'll see the P prime, and you can check me to make sure I do the same prime, same P prime for each of the points in the lift. If I choose a different P prime for a different lift of the thing in the cover, I'm up the creek. Okay. Good. Keep me honest here. Now, another concept are self-stresses. The stresses are weights associated to each edge. Again, these have to do with the homotopy class of the points. By the way, different people have different ways of saying this. Alyssa Ross, Walter's student, thinks of these as points with... what do you call it?
Gains.
Yes, gains. She did not invent that. She picked that off a different thing. And then was it Theron? Alyssa calls these colored points and so on. It just confuses me. So, but anyway, this. So I'm being a little. I'm sweeping some of the stuff under the rug here, but again, this has to do with the homotopy type of edge between the ith and the jth vertex. And again, this is associated to the edge between the two. So when you look back up in the plane, this is a vector equation at every vertex j. And I'll show you again what this looks like. This is the same thing in Euclidean space. What does it mean to be in equilibrium? What does that vector equation look like for self-stress? So when you have disks like this are touching another disk, there's you can think of the vector this minus this and this minus this minus and so on. And so these vectors, these weighted vectors, are like this. And this is a way you can see that they all add up. You add up the vectors head to tail as you go around, and that's the sort of graphical a way of verifying that something is in equilibrium. In the finite case, back in Euclidean space, this is an old picture. I learned this from Walter and Henry about graphical statics. And they learned it from reading, what? I don't know. Janosch Box. Janosch Box. That's right. That's right. Yeah. So this is old-fashioned stuff. Anyway, it's a nice way of thinking about it. Okay. Now, so one thing you can think of a packing graph as a strut tensegrity on a fixed torus, and I want to know when it's infinitesimally rigid. Now, one very useful theorem with Ben Roth and Walter Whiteley, they were thinking again of the case in Euclidean space where you have a ordinary tensegrity like we see here, but nevertheless, you can, I claim, you can use it on a torus. You can say a strut tensegrity on a torus is infinitesimally rigid if and only if it's infinitesimally rigid as a bar framework. Remember, that was the equality definition. That seems to be easier. And that has a stress with all the stresses non-zero of the same sign. Now, actually, they should be negative. That's the proper way of thinking of it. But you can change it. Who cares? It still keeps the equilibrium condition. So you could change the sign to be all positive if you want. Okay. And this is necessary and sufficient for infinitesimal rigidity. But of course, infinitesimal rigidity does not... Not every rigid object is infinitesimally rigid. And we'll see some examples of that. Okay? All right. So this is my one proof. So here is a proof that of this theorem. If you have a toroidal strut tensegrity, for instance, coming from packings, then what you can do, I can say, is that it's rigid. It's actually rigid if and only if the graph is infinitesimally rigid. The if part is very general. This, in many general, if you have something that's infinitesimally rigid, it's rigid. It's in the bar case, it's related to the inverse function theorem. And Walter and I have a general proof for tensegrities. Walter has another very clever proof for tensegrities. But anyway, so that sort of always happens. Now, the other part that's surprising is the only if. That means that if it, a way to interpret it is, if it has an infinitesimal flex, then it actually has a real motion. Now, it could be either because there's an infinitesimal motion of the bar framework, or there's no stress. There's no positive stress. Yeah. Either one could happen. So, in any case, there's this guy, and remember, it satisfies, see if I can go back quickly, it satisfies this equation at every edge. So, here's my proof that if you have one of those, you can actually make a real motion out of that. This doesn't always happen. It's very special to this. So here's the motion. You take the thing for t equals 0, you start off at the given configuration, and then just push it in the direction of the infinitesimal motion. Again, you know, I have to play with lifts and stuff. And here's the calculation. This is the distance squared between those two points at time t. Here it is written out. And then you expand it. It's like expanding a quadratic. I hope I did this right. Here's the original length. Now, when t is positive, this thing, this is positive. This inner product is positive. That's what you want for a struct tensegrity. And then this other term, the squared term, works in your favor. You only increase more when you have that. That's what's different. So when you have a strut, this sign is always right. If it's mixed strut and cables, then you can't do this trick. And it works just fine. There's a similar calculation for a hyperbolic surface. It's even better. The only thing that can happen that's sort of ugly is when some pairs of points are equal, some velocities are equal, and then what happens is they'll travel along right next to each other. But otherwise, they'll increase strictly. They'll actually move apart strictly, and that's useful for packings. So that's it. That's my one proof. It's trivial, but still. Okay. Now, so a corollary of this is just from linear algebra. You need, because there's only, let's say I'm thinking in the plane, there's only a two-dimensional set of variables. Each variable gives two, each vertex gives two variables. So there are 2n variables, but you might as well fix one. So that'll give you 2n minus 2. But you need one more because there are inequalities. Every time you have a bunch of linear inequalities, in order for that to define, say, the origin, to intersect only the origin, you need one more than what you need for hyperplanes. And so that means 2n minus 1. So if you have fewer than 2 minus 1 edges, then you know that packing is not locally best. At least some part of it will peel off, and you can move them apart, then increase the distances, and it's not locally maximally dense. Okay? Now, here's the next part. How do you find the graph? Well, the vertex, if you have equal circles in the plane, the vertex can't be worse than the local kissing number. In the plane, it's 6. It has to have a self-stress with all the stresses the same sign. Up to homo, there not every graph. If you take a graph and you spread it apart too much, it's clearly not going to be too far. So the lengths of the paths can be a priori restricted. Now this the second part here. This the global rigidity part. This is another thing that has come up. This is a very simplified version of it. So let me see if we can talk about this. Okay, I'll mention more about global rigidity in a minute with spider webs. So a packing is collectively jammed. That's just the definition that Saltorcaro and the rest of us came up with. Just means it's rigid as a whole ensemble. But I'm thinking also for a fixed lattice, a fixed shape of the torus. So a consequence of let's say it's collectively jammed, then this canonical push says that you have to have at least this many contacts, this number of edges. Now, let's look at the five-disc packing that Will found. It has a graph with 5 nodes, and if you count, there are 2n minus 1 edges. So it passes that test for being locally rigid, for being collectively jammed. It is collectively jammed. It has to be. But if you go to a cover, which means taking a sublattice, so in this picture over here, we have the torus, and if you lift to another torus between the universal cover and here, That's what I call, if it's k-fold, if they're k, you know, if it's k to 1, I call it a k-fold cover, then what happens is you multiply the number of nodes by k, and you multiply the number of edges by k, and then, oh dear, you have too few edges, which means that if you take that 5-disk packing and think of it as a 25-disk packing on a triangular torus, it's not the best. It's not even locally the best. So something is going wrong. So this 2n minus 1 business can't work. So you have to do better. Here is the other thing. So keep that in mind. Now, here is the way I think of the global properties of this. Now, this looks a little asymmetric. I kind of did this by hand, so don't get too fussy about the shape of this thing. But anyway, so this is supposed to be the 5-disk packing. Now, you can think of these lattice elements, the one vertex is fixed, and then you have all of these others here. I'm thinking of it as a cabled tensegrity instead of a strut tensegrity. And there's nothing but cables. So the claim is that if you have another realization of this in the same homotopy class, you know what I mean by homotopy class, then it's unique. There's no other realization with those same edge lengths or less. That's sort of the wrong way. We want it to be smaller. But anyway, this restricts the type of things you can look at. And although you can't see it from this picture, it also means that if the symmetry of the packing, this thing has dihedral symmetry or something like that, if you have the graph has a symmetry that follows the symmetry of the pack of the lattice, then the abstract symmetry of the graph has to be a real symmetry of the actual graph itself. So it has this threefold symmetry and a reflection symmetry. So that allows you to find the actual graph if it looks like this. So the packing, the best packing, tells you something just from the symmetry. So this is what I call a spider web. If you have a finite bunch of pin points and the configuration is in equilibrium with all stresses positive, then there's a unique configuration. That's the only one with those edge lengths or less. Okay. So that's my plug for global rigidity. That's a global property, but it's global up to homotopy class. So so this is what I was saying. The radius has to be less. It's sort of you want it to be not more, but if there's another realization where it is the best packing, it will be stressed, and then this thing will compare with it. So it does say something about packing. It looks like the inequality is going the wrong way. So here's an application, and I have, so you should wake up now, because I'm going to give you a test. Okay, so this is the Kagome lattice. We've seen something like that before, and here it is, the fundamental region is this thing, here, 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 and here, all the yellow disks. And then there's a green and a white, so there are three disks on the triangular lattice, and here's the motion. Here is the infinitesimal motion. It goes this way. Now, I have to be sure, you have to watch, that I do the same motion on all the lifts of the same thing. So that arrow there must be a translate of that arrow over there, the same here, and the same for the rest. And you can see that it does. It moves like this. Now, this has a stress. In fact, it has three independent stresses, all going along the straight lines. So that thing is actually rigid as a bar graph on this triangular torus. But as a strut graph, what happens is you do this canonical push in this direction, and things open up. Okay. And interesting, if you play the generic game, generically, the thing is rigid as a bar graph. It's just in this situation, it isn't. So you have to be careful, all these little quantifiers on the experiment. With me here? Okay, now I'll give you a test. Here's the thing. I gave a similar talk to this a few weeks ago, and one of the people there came up with this. I said, well, I would like to have realizations so that there aren't any big holes. Well, here's a baby with big holes. This is a packing of, I'll mention it later, this is it. This is the packing. It's on a triangular lattice. These are all the same. These points in the center here are all the same. What do you think? Does it look rigid to you? Will is looking real hard. What do you think? Let me give you another picture of this. Well, let me give you some data. Here, there are 30 nodes, 30 packing elements in that. It has 63 edges. So it's got just, I'm talking about the fixed torus. So it's got four more edges than you need, than the minimum. So it's really overbraced. And there is a positive self-stress. You can see that. You can see that later. This was suggested by Ruggiero. Yeah, you can see it. You can see it too, Walter. What it is let's go back here. Yeah, that's right. Every region is a regular polygon. So what you can do is join the centers of every regular polygon like this, and then the ratio between this length and the length of the distance between the centers is the stress, as it turns out. Okay, so it's a little advanced stuff here, but that's okay. Okay, so this is my argument. So it has more than enough. This is really, are you convinced it's rigid now?
No.
Okay, let's make it even harder. Okay, so what we can do is we can fill in the holes. Here's one that really makes it tough. We're going to fill in the hexagonal holes. You're going to actually put a disk in there, and it touches all of the others. And you can fill in the big clock holes with seven disks. Jiminy Christmas, that's really filling up the holes. So everything you get now is triangles and squares. Now that's rigid, isn't it? No, I didn't even count. It's got so many. Jeez. It's got its average degree greater than 5. The average degree should be a little less than 4. And now it's got average degree greater than 5. This is really overbraced. Watch. Oh, that's so much fun. Let's do it again. There, it's moving before your eyes. Okay, now you might say, look, it's stressed, so you can't move it as a bar framework. I proved it. As a bar framework, it's rigid. It's globally rigid in that sense. So you can't move it. It's a bar, but okay, I'm not moving it as a bar framework. The whole lattice moves, but as you'll notice from the symmetry, the fundamental region of this thing did stay the same. It's still on the same shape as a triangular torus, but what's happening is if you keep the edge length fixed, the torus is decreasing in area. It starts off where the derivative is zero, but then it once it gets going. So in between, it has an infinitesimal motion, but it actually has an infinitesimal motion as a bar framework, even when it starts, but it's equality, it's as a bar framework.
Does the motion have anything to do with the apparent projection from
That's a good question. You're a Maxwell Cremona person, I can tell. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good question. The original thing did. But this one, well, it moves, so it can't have a positive stress. The thing moves with a non-zero derivative, so it can't have a stress. So it can't be a projection of these little things here. They can't be flat when you do a Maxwell Cremona, I don't think. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm talking to experts here. You don't have to pay attention. But the idea is that these angles here and here are complementary. That's because in the rhombus, the angles, the opposite angles or adjacent angles, are complementary, and they're arranged so that they, when this decreases, that increases, and vice versa, and they all just amazingly fit together, and when you're done, I stopped here, this is now the hexagonal packing again, because I stopped when this thing is a unit distance apart. That's, if it were a packing, that's when it would stop. So the way to think of it, what I mean by this is you keep the torus fixed, and then as it moves, each of the distances increase, so you're increasing the size of the packing like this. At first, I couldn't tell. In fact, what happened, I gave this to Sal Torcato, and he gave it to a student, the original one with the holes already there, and they concluded that the thing was not infinitesimally rigid, but possibly changing the size of the torus. And this does even better, even with the fixed torus. It's surprising how this is. I think of this as a model for zeolites, that you can put these big holes in there and you get this maximum size and so on. And there are many others. There are a lot of other ways. So you can think of the packing as taking the triangular lattice and slicing out various edges. If you do it randomly, this is an old question, an old thing that was done by Mike Thorpe. Ed Thorpe is the guy who beat the dealer. But Ed Thorpe did this, and his colleagues, where you really needed the thing to be pretty much, he was interested in generic rigidity. And if you randomly do this, you get something that's generically rigid. In fact, this is generically rigid, even in the in-between things. But the thing is not generic. Okay. So, this is one comment. If you want to find the best packings, what you can do is try to find graphs and then adjust the graphs. Rather than let them grow and bounce around, just choose a graph and see which one is best. That may not be a wonderful algorithm, but it might help you find some interesting examples. And here's another comment about this, about the standard algorithms for computing packing or increasing packing density. This is a plague, I think, of computer simulations for packings. It's what I call contact ambiguity. How do you know if two things are touching? Well, you just plug it in and you see if there's an inequality. But these things can be really, really close, and maybe it's well beyond your thing. So here's an example. Is that the graph of a packing? This is your second quiz. Packing of equal circles. Okay, you have to look at it. I do this in my classes. Should we take a vote? Well, this one is missing up here. That's an outlier. I don't care about that. Okay. No, it's not. Why not? This one?
That one.
Yeah, that's right. And what happened is when they did this simulation, they showed me pictures like this, and they said, Bob, here's the graph. And I said, excuse me. And so they refined things so that it was right. So that's a problem. If you're going to fuss with the graphs, you have to worry, but is it really the graph of a packet? Right. So this is one thing. What can you do for packings? How can you find the graph of a packing in a triangular torus? That's can you find something that's locally rigid? These are the spines of the packing I mentioned earlier. The question is, there could be rattlers of a sort. Actually, in higher dimensions, I think you can have two disjoint rattlers, two disjoint spines that are both rigid. It's a weird situation, but I don't think you can have that here. But anyway, there seem to be, in cages, I'll show you a picture in a minute of rattlers. And what do the fault lines look like? It's when you do a random packing of equal disks and you jam them together, you got a lot of triangles. And the question is, where the seemingly triangles are missing, these fault lines, do they necessarily go around the torus? Or do they? Can they go around the circle? If they do, then you have something, something that might be a counterexample to Fetish-Toth conjecture. And how big can the holes be? This thing of Rubio's was a possible example. It failed. How big can the angle be? Even with his example, the angle was the internal angle was 120 degrees or 150 or something. But if there's a limit, then there's a limit to how big the holes can be. That's one thing. There's an example due to Barutsky where you have an infinite packing in the plane where everything is held fixed by its neighbors. But the whole thing falls apart when you just move at least eight of them altogether just by counting. Yeah, the question is, what do the holes look like? That's sort of what number five looks like. And so this is the last thing. This is an example from a random packing. So you can see that these more or less touch, and these are the rattlers. Rattlers are holes that are not triangles. Holes with small area, actually, are the possible, they could possibly lead to counterexamples to Fetish-Toth conjecture, or my generalization of it. And this is the kind of thing that can come up. Now, there's one thing that you really need in order to make this all work, and here it is. You need an extra step. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, if you want to go to my website, it's on my. The thing disappeared, didn't it?
Is it up there? Cornell.
Yeah, that's it. That's where to go. Right. Right. And I think. What's missing is this. Yeah, here we are. And so you can choose all kinds of examples. These all are in the catalog. This is in the catalog. This is a baby toy. Any of you seen that? And you're welcome to play. Yes.
In the beginning of the talk, you gave a list of numbers for lattice triangular.
Yes. Oh, I don't know. It's very. This is. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is little number theory. It's nothing. No big deal.
The other question is there any energetics aspect to minimal configurations that would cause these things?
Well, that's sort of what's going on. There's a quadratic function. It's not a quadratic. These are sort of related to homogeneous quadratic forms, and that sort of object where you have a spider web with things that are essentially fixed is a quadratic function. It's almost the same thing, and that's the energy form. And it only has one minimum, and that's essentially what's happening. And you can generalize this to more general things. That's what engineers do when they want to show one of these things are rigid. There's effectively an energy in the background that's being minimized, at least locally. One of the packings?
I'll find it on your site later.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Maybe. That's it.
Yeah. Oh, that's the best for five, yeah. Right.
Does that occur in nature?
Well?
I don't know.
I don't know. Well, what happened was this comes up in one of these huge packings. I asked whether if there's any locally best packing, or changing the lattice as well, that's not obtained from taking a triangular lattice and plucking out sort of disks here and there. And this pentagon appeared, and it appeared in three copies. They weren't next to each other. They were braced with other things that went around it. That's what really surprised me. So it came up in nature in that sense, in the computer simulation, but not here. So you can use this arrangement, and okay, it doesn't work well when the thing you go to a cover, but if you brace it with other triangles around, which you can do, apparently there's a great variety of these things, ways to do it, that you can do. But apparently there are others too that are what we called strictly jammed. Things that are jammed with the shape of the torus changing. Those things are, maybe come up in nature. If you, I think physicists aren't too thrilled about packings of equal disks in the plane because I think they know it all. It's a triangular packing and these things crystallize everywhere. But the little fault lines and stuff I think are interesting. And these triangle and square packings are. I think they're very unusual, very interesting. Yes? At 5 o'clock in the morning, I think about these things. And, I think you could do an aperiodic version of some of these things as well. I think that makes sense. Except the quotient, by dividing out and taking the quotient, is a little funny. There are various ways around that. This thing, oh, where are we? This thing, not this. This thing has only 1 degree of freedom. It's a little bit like what Ilyana did with pseudo triangulations. You put in enough bars in order to leave just 1 degree of freedom left. And it's interesting, you could play other games with that sort of thing, too. And I have the feeling you could do that with a pseudo-triangle. That's a question. Can you do this sort of thing with 1 degree of freedom with a pseudo-triangulation? With a quasi-aperiodic things. In fact, there's a group in Michigan that were trying to find the best packing of congruent pentagons. And the best packing, the record, was one that was periodic. But meanwhile, this group in Michigan found aperiodic versions of the best packing of congruent triangles, which is very interesting. It's aperiodic in one direction. Yeah, I think this could be fit into the theory, but it's it's not something I I don't have any examples in my back pocket.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.